Never mind, Philip, and thank you very much to you for the news, and thanks before that to Freddie Allen for the past 4 hours of excellent music on Radio Hallam. And it's hello from me, Roger Brooks. Welcome to a programme in which I'll be using the magic of recording tape to remind you, if you heard them when they were first broadcast, or introduce you, if you didn't, to some of the funny, argumentative, and interesting views expressed by guests in our Sunday evening Hallam Forum during 1981. You'll be hearing from men and women in politics, the church, show business, sport, and a wide range of other activities. Stay tuned, I can promise you'll enjoy it as we look back at the forums of 81. Started the year in fine form on sport with three of our Hallam experts. They were Peter Jenkins, Graham Chatfield and David Hayward in the studio, ending the first programme of the year way back in January with me putting them on the spot, asking them, among other things, to predict which of the Hallam Big Six would go up or down. Well, cast your minds back. It's hard enough, of course, to predict at Christmas time. And sometimes they were right, and sometimes, just once, they were nearly right. I asked them about promotion hopes for our local teams and began with Peter Jenkins on Sheffield Wednesday.
I would say the future for Sheffield Wednesday has never been brighter since in the 6 years I've been with Hallam. A fine young squad of players. I don't believe they're going to go up this season. I don't believe they're ready for it. They'd come straight back down if they did. But watch them next season.
So you'd side with the hint of a couple of weeks ago that Jack made, that maybe he doesn't want it this year. He withdrew
I think he'd like it. I think he'd like it. He'd be silly not to. But they're not
too
ready.
Much too
they're
soon.
Not ready.
Graham?
I agree with Peter. A young side with loads and loads of talent. There's certainly four, five, six players who do well in the First Division now, even though they are very young. I think, it's hard to say. You see, there's not much competition in the Second Division. I mean, they could even go up. I'm not saying they will. They could, because there aren't many good sides in the Second Division.
David?
Perhaps they may just miss out. One worrying fact is if 12 months ago you would have said that Sheffield Wednesday would have been up in the upper reaches of the Second Division and have told me at the same time they would only have been getting 15,000 spectators per home match, that is a great deal more worrying.
Tends to reinforce the fact that you've got your spectators if they're loyal wherever you are and not... success doesn't bring too many extra these days, as Aston Villa may be proving. But don't think you're getting off that easily. Are they going to go up just in one word? Sheffield Wednesday, Peter?
No, not this season.
Graham?
No.
David? No. Okay. United?
I've lost too many games already. to be promoted from the Third Division, you lose 11 games at the maximum. United have already lost 11. Statistically, no, and they're not playing well enough.
Graham?
No, I believe they've got enough decent players to make a bid for promotion, but they've not really sorted themselves out yet.
David?
No, I think times have changed since those days when I used to go some 10 years ago.
Rotherham United, Peter?
Very good chance indeed, Roger. Best Rotherham squad I've seen in the last 6 years. I would say there's a very, very good chance indeed. I would go down for a yes.
Good, yes. All right, what about you, Graham?
I'd like to see them just lose a couple of games and see what happens to them then, before I'm sure, but they've definitely got an outstanding chance.
Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, David. For me, Ian Porterfield, a man with ideas and ambition.
Yeah, hear, hear.
Okay. Barnsley, Peter.
Best team I've seen in the Third Division this season. Best organised, terrific team spirit. And if I were to stack my money on anybody, it would be on Barnsley.
Graham?
Haven't seen them for about 18 months.
OK, we'll allow you a graceful withdrawal from that one.
A graceful withdrawal on that score.
You too. Oh, David.
Well, Keith,
we can't
them.
Watch them
Keith
all,
Keith Lodge
can we?
Thinks they're going up too.
Keith Lodge thinks they're going to be the team to beat Liverpool at Anfield, doesn't he? Chesterfield.
I think Chesterfield, I'm sad to say, will miss out. I've seen a fair bit of them, and I just feel they're going to miss out this season.
Graham?
Yes, it'll be a terrible tragedy having just missed out last year, but they may well struggle to go up.
David, have you seen them?
Yes, footballing side, but they may not go up through to the quality of their pitch that may let them down.
OK, quickly round, Doncaster, Peter, in a word.
Not seen Doncaster this season, can't comment.
Graham?
I've seen them a couple of times, very young, but they could get lucky.
Echoed, yes.
There we are. Well, how right David Hayward was there, sneaking in right at the end. Of course, none of the team had the nerve to suggest the unthinkable that did happen, of course, when United actually went down. Although they did have one game, they took that far-seeing Ian Porterfield. But the team were right about Barnsley, Rotherham, Doncaster, Chesterfield and Wednesday. Well, in March, one of the area's political heavyweights, Conservative Irvin Patnick of South Yorkshire County Council, told us on Forum about how he heard of his OBE honour.
I went to bed on the... it was either the night of the 30th or the 31st, I can't remember which. And
31st of
December or... Yeah, it was New Year's Honours List, List. And someone rang... my wife answered the phone, and this man was ecstatic because he'd been listening to a station by the name of Radio Hallam, and he'd heard the fact that I had the OBE on, won the OBE, or been given the OBE, and he suggested I listen to the next news, and I listened to the 1 o'clock news in the morning, and of course all I heard on that was that Arthur Askew got the CB and Robin Dead been knighted. So somewhere about 3:30 in the morning, I decided the best thing to do was to go into town and try and buy a newspaper. And they were trying to buy a newspaper at 3:30 in the morning.
I've never had cause.
It's quite funny. Anyhow, I found a man who was delivering newspapers, and I thought, I'll get one of these when he's gone. And I thought, I can just imagine recently awarded OBE caught by police stealing newspapers. So I went to the bloke and I said, did he mind if I had one of his papers? And we spread this out on my bonnet, and it wasn't on the front page, and it wasn't on the next page, and somewhere in the small print, there it was, my name with the OV. And when I got back, which was even funny, it was on the front page, it was on another page, and there was quite a bit about it. But, you know, you're looking for your own name, and it's something, actually, that you always see your own name in anything that's... any writing anywhere, any print, and that was it. And then Tuesday I went down, and the Queen presented me with a medal, which is... quite an experience. Even I was overawed, and takes a lot.
I was going to say, because you're quite a widely travelled man.
Oh, I am. Much travelled from here to Barnsley and places like that. Yeah. And that's on the map now, isn't it? Yes. The most amazing thing about it all is at no time did anybody say, you know, prove who you are, where do you live or anything. You go through and your name is ticked off on lists. And
so if all our terrorist friends are listening out there, they know what to... Yeah.
No, I think it's a bit... swifter than that when you get inside, but it's the most beautifully decorated place, because if you go to a garden party, you sort of go into the palace and out through the back door and you're back in the lawn. But this one, you actually go through, and there's huge paintings and most marvellous thing, and it was just a nonchalant little stroll looking at beautiful antiques until suddenly you get to a door and you look in. It's like looking in a theatre, and the Queen is there with her ADCs and similar people around. There's a huge audience. I know my stomach went... And suddenly it all happened. And then when you actually hear your name called, that's when all the butterflies start going, and then you arrive in front of the Queen and she actually speaks to you. And that again, is quite a traumatic thing. And the most amazing thing is everybody says, well, what did you say? If I tell you, I couldn't remember. Mm. And, we had a conversation which was for minutes, and I roughly know what we discussed, because she opened County Hall in... about 70-something or other. But that's all I can remember.
It was a non-political speech, I take it.
It was a very, very nice speech, and I did explain to her what a beautiful building it was.
6:30. In a moment, SEX.
It's a must! Formula One stock car racing at Ullerton this Monday with your favourites, Frankie Wainman, Dave Meller, Willie Harrison, Dave Beresford and Alan Barker in the Sheffield Christmas Cracker Championship. Ullerton this Monday at 2:30. Be there!
Spend a little time and save a lot.
In Peck, suede leather and fur sale, the town's largest selection and all reduced. So full-length conies are down from £183.50 to £100. Coney jackets only £29.95. Real mink jackets before £576, now £476. Real sheepskins usually £169, now £129. And conies up to size 22, down from £99.50 to £79.95 at Peck's of Bridgegate, Rotherham.
From this Monday, Gregory and Dent, Sheffield's most experienced Renault dealer, start their Bonus Deal 82. Yes, buy any new Renault, and after the normal deposit by cash or part exchange, it's spring before you pay another thing. Because Gregory and Dent pay your first two, yes, first two instalments. Some Renault models have interest-free finance too. And of course, Gregory and Dent always have a fabulous selection of quality used cars. So it pays to see Gregory and Dent, Halifax Road, Sheffield, for the best Renault deal yet.
Welcome back. Well, in May, the subject of sex raised its none-too-ugly head on Forum, when a gentleman called Glenn Wilson, author of a book called Love and Instinct, found his assertions under challenge from local woman Diana Luke and from Dr. Janet, our resident family practitioner.
Sex is a very powerful instinct involving scarce commodities, and you put in bracket attractive women, and therefore provoke lethal conflicts in the same way as competition for other forms of power and property. Now, the way I read that, for, you know, forgive me if I read it differently to you, obviously, but I see it as you're putting a woman as a trophy to be displayed in a games room. You know, it's a power and property thing, like a mortgage or something. I really was quite angry about that.
That appears to be the fact of the matter, and I speak now as a scientist rather than a moral philosopher. Men do compete for women. It's undeniable. They fight with each other, primarily, not just for women, they fight for land and all kinds of other forms of property, but women is one commodity that they do fight over, much more than women fight physically over men.
Yes, you may think it's evil, but what Glenn's saying is that it is a fact. Men do like to parade their beautiful trophies to an extent.
Well, I think there's another side to that attitude as well. The feeling of ownership that so many men have over their wives, you know, my shoes, my house, my wife. Which was one of the things I found about being married that I could upset me. I am a person. I don't belong to anybody else.
Yeah.
Should not get married because property rights seems to be the basis of a marriage relationship.
Why can't you work on an equal relationship? Why are you suggesting that a man must own the woman?
I would take you up, Glenn, on this question about gorillas. I haven't studied gorillas personally. Nor even orangutans. But one of the big differences between human beings and gorillas at the moment is that we have effective methods of birth control, which to a certain extent gives the woman time to have children as and when she wishes, and not as the man
wants.
That's
right. And that being the case, you would think that the male-female differences ought to have collapsed to some extent. Now, the extraordinary thing is that they have not, to any appreciable extent, collapsed. We still find that males are lustful and adventure-seeking. We still find women trying to establish long-term relationships. And the reason, of course, is that our genes have not had time to adapt to the availability of contraception. We have not had a chance to evolve instincts which would take account of our ability to control birth.
Oh, yes, this is rather dreadfully common. Even amongst many parents these days, you know, it's okay for the son to go off and have a bit on the side, but the daughter has got to be
pure.
Not only pure and
virginal.
This, that and the other, but to stay that way.
Isn't that still, though, more of a throwback to the fear of her becoming pregnant than it is to the fear of her becoming promiscuous? Or having
fun? Well, I don't know. It's not a terribly easy thing to reason with people about. I think it's more an emotional thing, and it's very difficult to reason with an emotion.
Yes, it is a throwback, but it's a throwback to way back in our evolutionary history, where men are concerned about their paternity, their interest in the children that they are being held responsible for. They don't want to be cuckolded. They don't want to be raising children that are not carrying their genes. And this, of course, is not conscious. It's occurring at the level of instinct. And this is why they sequester wives and chase off other males, and why they are more subject to sexual jealousy than women, because they want to be damn sure that if they are raising those children, that they have a genetic investment in them.
But to go back to an original point I made and in support of the women, doesn't it appear that your book is actually giving ground to reinforce a man's natural tendencies rather than pointing him in the direction of making things a bit fairer?
Again, I'm not preaching any particular kind of behaviour. I'm hoping that through this book people will gain a better understanding of themselves and the opposite sex, so that we'll be in a better position to arrive at a reasonable compromise.
Can I take a point up there? If we're supposed to understand better by reading your book, well, I don't understand by reading it. You say female orgasms do not come naturally, whatever the social conditions, they always have to be worked at. Now, yeah. That sounds like a man saying that. There are women listening to this programme. There's no way they're going to listen to that.
One of the prime references there comes from Sherry Hyatt, who is a woman who found that a very high proportion of even liberated women in the United States who comprised her sample. Her sample was obtained through feminist magazines, and the vast majority of those women said they had great difficulty obtaining orgasms reliably.
If it means having an orgasm with a man, perhaps it's because the man doesn't understand the woman, and if it's like you, you don't understand women by the sound of it.
Diana Luke. Well, five of us at Hallam submitted our handwriting for anonymous analysis by TV graphology expert Diane Simpson back on May the 31st. Some of her verdicts were too close for comfort. But what about this opinion?
Now, this, for handwriting analyst, is the one of the two that remain. Artistic, creative, high-flying ideas, idealist, very bright, probably the brightest of the ones you've given me. Some personal vanity also. Although intuitive, he may on occasion will appear to exercise rather an excess of logic. This is a person who can't resist analysing or criticising things. I'm afraid there's an element of sarcasm here, a dry wit, sharp, lively sort of a wit. Goal-orientated, but not if it means giving things up. For instance, I can't imagine... this is a man going without his food. Not without good food. Probably got interesting tastes in food, art, bit of a culture vulture. One thing very interesting.
Turn round, Roger. We're talking about you.
Are we?
This is Roger.
I was just getting the nutcrackers.
Two things.
Are you going to put in for a rise tomorrow? Brightest of these.
I'm the brightest, am I? You said I'm the brightest here. Mm.
Brightest of these samples.
Yes. Superb bluffer, mischievous. And hates to be kept waiting.
He doesn't like being kept waiting. I do not.
If you're going places, travel, woodcock, travel. Travel, woodcock, travel anywhere. 'Cause we care at Woodcock Travel, everywhere with Woodcock Travel. Travel, Woodcock, travel, and you're there.
Slate Award will furnish your home. Slate Award will save you money.
And especially in their sale, starting on the 28th, with every item in stock over three floors reduced, including beds, three-piece suites, dining, bedroom, kitchen, and occasional furniture, and quality wool Axminsters with some Roll-Ems and stock vinyls half price. Plus, 12 months interest-free credit when you spend £200 or more on stock purchases in the sale at Slate Award in Infirmary Road, Sheffield.
Get a great deal and a great deal more at Slate Award.
Non-stop, round the clock. 24 hours a day.
18 and a quarter minutes past 6 on Radio Hallam, where you're listening to the pick of Hallam Forum 1981. In July, women's magazine Agony Aunt Claire Shepherd was on Forum, denying that all those worried blue eyes letters are made up.
I don't have to make them up. There's nothing so strange as folks, and there would be no point in me trying to make a letter up. The letters come to me. What I do have to do, and that is to cut down the length of the letters that when I publish them. Very often those letters are 10 pages long. I have to take the gist of what the person has written to me, and we use that. But there's no reason to make them up, because I could fill the magazine with those problems.
Now, certainly you, in Woman's Realm, your particular field, you have an offer for people to write in and receive a private reply if they think it's too personal or if you can't cope with it on the page. Is this pretty common, or do I think I've seen most of them saying, unfortunately, we can't go into individual queries?
No, the major women's national weeklies, they all answer all the letters that are sent to them, provided there's a name and address to send them to. The answer to. I answer every letter. I don't answer every letter personally.
I was going to say, what sort of team do you head?
I've got a social worker who answers quite a number of them for me. I've got a doctor, a lawyer. I've even got a psychiatrist when I need her. But my own feeling about that is that if the problem is so difficult that it needs a psychiatrist to answer it, then I have to be very careful and just more or less say, you know, you really need help and I suggest that you go to your doctor.
You can tell from the letter, can you?
Yes, if they're very disturbed.
What about that, I think it was one of the schoolgirls that Christine or Jane was talking to there that said she had often wanted to write in, but she was afraid that you would, presumably inadvertently, publish the name, or somebody might publish the name.
No, certainly I wouldn't. We never publish names and addresses, and if I think that the letter is identifiable, I wouldn't use it.
So would you sometimes change if somebody said, my boyfriend Sandy does this and my mother June does that? You might even change the names or
I don't
or not
use the names. It would be impossible for anybody to know who wrote the letter.
You don't even put in much location, do you? As
no. To where no, occasionally. If it's important in the problem, if the person lives in Scotland and Scottish law is different, it's sometimes to ours, then I will say, this reader comes from Scotland.
Obviously you're glad to have the job and you enjoy the job or you wouldn't have been doing it for 22 years, but some people would see it as a very sad reflection on society that such people as you and Claire Rayner and Marge Broops and Evelyn Holm and all the others, Anna Raban, actually exist by answering these kinds of questions.
Well, we do have a much lonelier society now than we used to have. I mean, at one time you had your mother living round the corner and aunts and uncles. You had people to go to. But I think now people do lead lonelier lives. But I don't really look at it like that. I just look upon myself as an ear over the garden fence.
That ear belonging to Claire Shepherd. Well, the outspoken comments only this week by BBC television newsreader, the icefall victim Kenneth Kendall, about his disillusionment with falling standards in not weather, but news presentation, is given very interesting views when we look back at the comments of a former top ITN newsman, Gordon Honeycomb. He was on Forum in August, telling us about his book on the royal wedding, but also chatting about what he thought made a good newsreader.
Well, I think the basic requirements for being a newscaster are actually very few and then don't actually relate to journalism. I think all you have to have is a good voice, a good appearance, and in a way, to be good, to have a good manner and behaviour, and indeed in your public and private life to an extent. I think that is that's all that's required of you, really. It has been dressed up now with the fact that you have to, of course, be a journalist yourself and be able to know what you're talking about. I don't think this actually applies. I think you have to be able to tell the stories, tell the news with interest and with intelligibility. And this doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be a journalist. I think the Peter Woon and BBC Television now employing television reporters as newsreaders, I think is maybe a mistake, because nothing against the particular persons who are now being employed to do that, but I think that they do not necessarily know how to project the news, that is the telling of each item. They may indeed, their actual knowledge of the stories and their own journalistic background may actually interfere with a sort of straight presentation. Mm. And I think someone like Kenneth Kendall, who is excellent, who is not a journalist as far as I know, who has no background of that sort, Richard Baker, extremely clear. People understand. They hear the news. They understand what is being said. They do not need journalists to tell them the news. Angela Rippon was a journalist indeed, and so indeed Anna Ford. But I think the best journalist is Leonard Parkin for reading the news. I think he actually tells and reads the news very well on top of that. And so does Peter Sissons, by the way.
Who's your favourite newsreader?
Oh, Kenneth Kendall, I would have said, actually. Because he reads the stories with a certain variety. I think Richard Baker tends to say everything as if in the same cheerful tone of voice.
S&E, the sale worth queuing for, starts Wednesday with many, many bargains, such as the Prelude Fashion Bed, was £592.50, yours for only £50. See our windows now. Sheffield and Ecclesall Co-op sale starts 9 a.m. Wednesday at the Arcade Moorfoot.
Hallam in stereo!
where it's exactly 25 minutes past six. Well, it's one of the functions of Hallam Forum to get people in the public eye to talk about other areas of their interests, like when Euro-politician South Yorkshire MEP Brian Key spoke about cricket, and especially the boycott Illingworth row that was boiling in September.
Well, I think people obviously overplay it, and the press obviously love to create it into, you are, boycott is either Satan or God, you know, and I think I read that in the paper this morning and I found that a bit overstating the case. I think it's something that people enjoy having a good, strong view about. Whether they take it that seriously, I'm not too sure about.
But obviously things, somebody within the dressing room was taking things seriously, or they both were, and the feeling is one of them will have to go or both of them will have to go. Would you like to put any money or even just a voice an opinion as to which one will go? Or whether they should?
Well, all I'm sure about is that for the last, 13 or 14 years, we've had a bad lot of results for Yorkshire cricket. We've not won anything since, 1968, is it? And whatever happens, we've actually got to sort it out, both the committee of Yorkshire cricket, the management of Yorkshire cricket, and we've also got to actually get the lads who are now coming up in the game in Yorkshire, actually get them in to the Yorkshire team and actually want to stay in the Yorkshire team and continue to play for Yorkshire.
It's a case of one man being slightly bigger than the rest of the team. Are you saying that Yorkshire's been successful despite the fact that it's had the world's greatest batsman, arguably, in it? Or are you saying that it's fair enough to say that one of the reasons is the fact that they've had this man overshadowing everything else?
No, I don't think it's because one man overshadowed. I just think there's been too many chopping and changing in Yorkshire, both captaincy and in the team. And it's obviously led to a lot of good players leaving the county. And also it's meant that people have finished up having rivalries between each other. And I don't think that's good for a team sport, cricket is.
It's one of the few organisations, Yorkshire County Cricket Club, that's got a permanent opposition in existence, isn't it? I mean, am I being naive in suggesting that other counties don't have an actual organised lobby group that's permanently on the committee's back like the Reform Group is?
I don't know. Most institutions and groups which I'm members of have people who are in the majority and other people that are in the minority, and it applies, I suspect, to everybody around this table.
All right,
in the groups they're in.
Let's ask John Hambidge, because you were nodding your head there, while we stay on cricket for a while, or one man being bigger than any team, whether it be Ron Greenwood, Peter Barnes or Geoffrey Boycott?
Well, I think Brian made the essential point when he said that cricket is a team game, and I don't think that you can necessarily blame Boycott or any one player for the lack of success within Yorkshire. I think it goes a lot deeper than that, and if you look back over the last 15, 20 years or so, the Yorkshire Cricket Club seems to have had a penchant for making mistakes. It's lost Close, it's lost Illingworth. It could well be losing Boycott, although admittedly in Boycott's case, he must be coming towards the end of his career.
Brian Key first there, along with John Hambidge, later of Sheffield Chamber of Commerce, on Geoff Boycott. And it's perhaps a good job Mr. Boycott can't hear that statement out in India. Well, at the end of September, I had the richest group of people ever assembled under Radio Hallam's roof on Forum. Five people who'd won fortunes on the football pools. The Greenwoods of Rotherham and the Dawes family of Sheffield, who both had big wins recently, and the spend-spend girl Viv Nicholson, all saying that pools wins don't mean the end of your problems.
Everybody, doesn't matter how close your friends are, you can never talk to them the same as you did before, because there's a barrier there, because you are different from them. You've got all this money and we're not sure how to bring it up in conversation. You know, we try not to bring it up in conversation, but if you're talking like to Elaine, we can talk about it. You can't talk about it, or it sounds as if you're bragging. But sometimes you want to talk about it to somebody just to make yourself feel normal. Because you can't.
You haven't got two heads.
There's a lot of people who fart shy of you now, and they point you out, they'll look at you. But not a lot of people will speak to you because they think you might bite the head off, or you might do this or the other. You haven't changed yourselves. But standard of living has changed. That'd be foolish to say otherwise. Standard of living has definitely changed. And the kids are appreciating the extra standard of living. That's where they're getting the benefit. That is fact. But We haven't changed. We don't think so anyway. We might go to different places. We eat out a little more often than we used to before. And, like they say, we enjoy life, but we always did anyway.
You did all move. None of you actually stayed in the same house. Was that a good idea?
Yeah, we didn't move far, Rose, I don't know about
No, we didn't move far either.
We'd only been in our place 3 months.
We'd lived in the
shop 3 months. Which I think a lot of people don't realise. They're all saying, well, you've left your flat now, what you left your little flat for? And it was an enormous flat, but we took the shop on solely, we sold his house, and with the proceeds from the house, we bought a business, and that was to better ourselves. But we moved simply because... Well,
we weren't going to continue.
We weren't going to continue getting up at 9 o'clock every morning while up at 5 every night when there were no necessity.
I suppose one of the problems is that if you do have problems of any kind, as you were saying, Dennis, you're going to get very little sympathy from other people. You know, it's the old cliche about the man whose Rolls Royce has broken down might find it harder to get a push than somebody in a minute.
Yeah, you can't push him.
We've had some lovely holidays. We've been to some lovely places, should I say. But you can't come back and say, we didn't reckon much to it. I mean, people just look at you and say, oh, they've been to Barbados, so they don't reckon much to it. I mean...
I've said I don't reckon much to it.
We didn't like it at all.
Because we're not big fanatics about going abroad, you know, but we're going in October for some while it's cold here, simply, plain and simply, when kids are on holiday.
Some people say that people who win a lot of money ought to give it to charity.
Yeah, charity
begins at home.
Yes, exactly.
Always will do, because I've been asking for charity and I haven't got
it. We haven't given money to any charities. We've been to a hospital and given them something. It wasn't money. But no way would anybody ever find out at the hospital, apart from our family that know it anyway, because it was very good to my son at one particular time, but no way would the press or anybody know what you
want.
It's nothing to do, as far as we're concerned, what we do with it is our business, really. And if anybody wants to try to poke the nose in, then I'm afraid we'll tell them where to put the nose, because it's nothing to do with them.
Keep this date, Monday the 28th, the first day of Atkinson's sale, with doorbuster specials like Fogarty polyester quilts, only £9.99. On the line at 9, pillowcases and hand towels, 50 pence, and bath towels, just £1. Then the great home and family bargains throughout the sale include big savings on blankets, now less than half price. So the single-size all-wool super merino is only £9.95. In Atkinson's sale, starting on the moor on the 28th at 9 a.m. See the Star Christmas supplement for full details.
You've got it, Radio Harbour. Yours in stereo.
The leader of Sheffield City Council, David Blunkett, was with us last month on Forum, talking at one point about the extent of central government interference in local council activities. But he was anxious to say that he didn't want opposition from local councillors ever to reach the street barricade state that they did in a recent television play, United Kingdom.
I sincerely hope not. I think it betrays some of the real difficulties that exist now with a legislation placed before Parliament, although it's being delayed somewhat, in terms of government powers to take over and to direct what local government does in terms of education and housing and social services. We have an example at the moment in one town in Norwich where the government are proposing to step in and take over the sale of council houses. Now, it's only a very small thing, but it does indicate that we are always on the borderline between a reasonable consent and people doing things in a sensible way and being allowed to have disagreements and to sort those out within our democracy, and the right of the centre to take over and to do things for us. And it's a bit of an irony that it's normally left-wingers who are abused and talked about in terms of centralisation, and yet it's usually the right-wing who actually carry out those deeds.
Would you say that you backed down on that particular issue as a council gracefully?
Well, we certainly wouldn't wish to get involved in any kind of physical or public conflict. What we wouldn't wish to back down is the right to be elected on a particular programme, and if you don't get elected, if other people get elected in your place, to accept that. I mean, that's what local and central representative democracy is all about, and no doubt people next May will make a judgment on our performance in the city, and we may find that we are not as popular as we think we are, but that's the people's right. That's what it's all about.
When South Yorkshire and maybe Sheffield in particular are mocked by the press or sections of the media as being extremist, does that cause you amusement or annoyance?
Well, I'm long since over being terribly annoyed by things. I think it does aggravate sometimes when it's carried to ridiculous proportions, because, you know, you're only an extremist if you don't agree with somebody. You're a good guy and it's ordinary, acceptable politics if you agree with me. So I find extremes those who don't believe in what I don't believe in, and I find those politicians who claim to be so-called moderates and middle of the roaders quite extreme in their own way. The big problem is that I'm not the one who's writing the editorials and determining what's put over in Current Affairs, and I accept their right to do that. I just wish that we'd all get off this bandwagon of believing that people are somehow a threat and a worry if they don't agree with you. It's a nonsense.
You mentioned earlier the conflict that can arise on a family basis through people being put down by the media or involved in very public debates on major issues that make them look as if they're taking a firm stand or a controversial stand. I mean, has this affected your home life or, to any drastic extent, the home life of anybody else you know who's involved in local politics?
Well, I certainly know of politicians whose home life has been completely ruined. I mean, they've made the decision, so, I mean, we mustn't sort of all cry crocodile tears for this. I mean, people actually know what they're letting themselves in for. The tragedy is when external things happen that because you are in the public arena. I mean, you're only a politician because you're in the public arena. We're all involved in decision-making and trying to change the world. And it does happen. I know, well, there are people who will be coming off the council on my side of the council chamber, the Labour Party side, next May because of the difficulties in coping with family life and the very difficult public arena we're now involved in. My own family, luckily, my wife's involved and interested and is committed, but it still has its strains and problems. When you get rung up after midnight by somebody who's got something very important to tell you, like that he hates your guts, then, you know, that is bound to have an effect on family life. And I have considered having an answering machine, but we haven't got round to it yet.
Councillor David Blunkett. Well, Flight from Northern Ireland could, I suppose, be the subtitle of a story that the Sun reporter for this area, Martin Sharp, told forum listeners in May. Martin was telling us of the time that he was stationed in Northern Ireland, covering the troubles there for his former newspaper, The Daily Mail.
Well, I look back at it now and it really doesn't seem as though it happened, but it did. It'd be 9 years ago, Roger. I was in Derry for the Daily Mail and we did a story about the IRA taking over a church to put over their message to the congregation. Well, it was a good story and the Daily Mail used it as front page lead. The next thing I knew about it, the next morning, I was staying at my hotel and I got a call from a provisional IRA man who said very simply that they wanted to see me. Well, you don't ignore that kind of summons, so away I went into the Bogside. At the time, it was a no-go area, and I told the Daily Mail what I was doing, and they said, well, you've really got to go. It might be a good story. Well, I went, and surprisingly, they were very friendly. I had tea with them. They cooked bacon and eggs, and we sat there and discussed this story, which they denied strenuously. And they said that we'd got to print the truth. Now, it's not every day that a journalist is summoned by the IRA, and it's not every day that he gets the chance, the opportunity, to meet them face to face. So I rang my office, and they said, we'll run the story. Really, it's intimidation. You're there and we can't ignore what they're saying. So I took the story, which was a straight denial, but it was interesting. And so from that point of view, I thought it was a good story. And we parted. I went back to my hotel, fully expecting the story to appear in the paper the next day. But at 9 o'clock at night, the phone rang and it was the editor, no less. Now, it's not very often that a journalist in the field gets a call from the editor. But there he was, and he said, Martin, I think I ought to let you know that we're not going to run this story tomorrow morning. Well, I must admit at that moment, sheer panic took over. There I was, 70, 80 miles from the nearest airport, and he was telling me that we weren't going to use the story. Well, I got in the car and I drove like hell. I got to the airport. There was no plane out of Ulster till the very next morning, and I knew full well that the papers would have arrived by then. The papers had been flown over from England. I got to get aboard a plane. It didn't really matter what kind of plane it was. I explained my predicament to British Airways, and they said, well, we sympathise. We've got a cargo plane going to London. How do you fancy that? Well, I fancied that very much, and I went.
Keep this date, Monday the 28th, the first day of Atkinson's sale with doorbuster specials like 4-inch super app insulation from only £2 a roll. On the line at 9, boys' Wrangler jeans, £3, Aristoc stockings, 20 pence, and Hyde swivel chairs, just £99.95. Then the great home and family bargains throughout the sale include up to a £49 saving on Fogarty Feather and Down Continental quilts, now from £16.99, in Atkinson's sale, starting on the moor on the 28th at 9. See the Star's Christmas supplement for full details.
Hi, Superthorn here. Starting Monday, December 28th, you're going to witness the greatest sale of tyres, batteries, exhaust systems and antifreeze. Even Superthorn has staged. However, this offer must end on December 31st. So snap up the guaranteed cheapest prices this year. Superthorn at Fawcett and Thorn.
I was seeing life through a glass window. It was like being in a kind of personal prison.
On Monday night, Hallam reports on schizophrenia, one of the most widespread, most crippling and most controversial mental disabilities. Nobody knows the cause, and there's fierce argument about the cure. We talk to the sufferers, the psychiatrists, and the world-famous so-called anti-psychiatrist Dr. R.D. Lang, who has said schizophrenia is not a disease at all.
I wouldn't treat my dog the way people are treated.
What is this disturbing condition that affects 150,000 people in Britain today? Is it brought on by abnormal brain chemistry or pressure in the family or both? Why is modern psychiatry itself split down the middle about its greatest, most baffling challenge?
Though psychiatry has a group for those who think they're being persecuted when they're not, it's quite interesting it has no group for those who are being persecuted and don't notice it.
Hallam reports on the mystery of schizophrenia, 7 o'clock, Monday night.
Radio Hallam, 194.
Welcome back to Radio Hallam's Hallam Forum Pick of the Year. Well, a few moments ago, just before the break, we heard from a programme in May in which Martin Sharp of The Sun was telling us a time and when he was working for the Daily Mail over in Northern Ireland and had to make rather a hurried exit. In that same programme, Martin Sharp and I discussed with a current Daily Mail reporter covering this area, Bob Turner, attitudes towards Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, as a subsequent trial confirmed him to be. First, Bob Turner.
Well, it annoys me. On the one hand, we've got all these people shouting about checkbook journalism, and then you knock on a door of some very obscure old school friend of the person involved. And they don't ask you, first of all, who you are or what you are or who you're representing. They immediately say, how much is it worth? I know the Daily Mail, contrary to popular opinion, haven't paid out a lot of money for various stories. I'd like to defend Mrs. Sutcliffe, who today various comments have come out in the Sunday newspapers from her. I know that she has not been paid a lot of money. I know that she was offered a lot of money. She was offered an awful lot of money for her life story. And she has consistently throughout, since Peter Sutcliffe's arrest in January, she has refused point blank to sign a contract with any newspaper.
There is a story, in fact, in this morning's Sunday Times, slating the press in general, but putting in a kind of gentle rider for themselves, saying everybody's ready with the sensational stuff, and indeed the Sunday Times were not quite as sensational, they apologise, but they were ready. But they cite the case of one particular Sunday newspaper whose editor and deputy editor were out on the streets with a bottle of whiskey and a cheque for, the figure mentioned, is £110,000 for her. Do you think we are going to see those memoirs somewhere?
Oh, I think that's a bit of sour grapes, and I love the bit about the bottle of whiskey. If they're going to pay £100,000, you know, a bottle of whiskey isn't going to make much difference. I think it's a bit of sour grapes. When I was up in Bradford right at the start of this, and Martin will remember it well, we were accused by the local evening paper up there of being all sorts of animals rushing around with checkbooks. We've got a job to do. We go and do it. If someone has something to say and we think it is worthwhile, then we will pay. But only if we think it's worthwhile. We will not go, and the Attorney General is watching this situation very closely, who in the Sutcliffe case is paid for their story. A, we can't, and B, we won't. We will not go in there and pay a lot of money.
Well, in Forum in August, Sheffield University's Professor Kenneth Watkins was a participant in one of several discussions throughout the year on Forum on the subject of nuclear disarmament.
In terms of conventional weaponry in Western Europe, the Soviet forces enjoy a roughly 3-to-1 advantage in terms of conventional weaponry. Therefore, if Britain was unilaterally nuclear disarmed, and one was successful in persuading one or two other European countries to join in the process, as my friend seemed to like, then the possibility of a movement by the Red Army and its supporting forces into Western Europe is on the cards. And let us say you may make jokes about oil, but given the economic problems, the living standards, the inefficiency, low productivity of that economy, apart from its arms production, in terms of the living standards of its people, the West, as a ripe apple, would be a very tempting target indeed. And therefore, the argument remains that although the last thing one wants is a nuclear exchange, because all of us in this room die, and I absolutely admit this, that for 30 years now, we have had peace through the mutual deterrence. One doesn't like the mutual deterrence because the accident even could occur. And therefore one presses for multilateral nuclear disarmament.
Here's another clue. There's only one.
Brighton Pier?
Oh, no, more exciting.
Miss World.
More spectacular.
Niagara Falls?
Getting colder.
The Eiffel Tower?
More colourful.
Guy Fawkes Night?
More unbeatable.
I've got it! There's only one Debenhams Winter Sale.
10 out of 10.
There's only one winter sale at Debenhams. It starts tomorrow.
24 hours a day.
And those 24 hours ticking round to 12 minutes to 7. Don't forget that next we have the news on Radio Hallam. But we move on from nuclear disarmament, one kind of peace, to another. In July, one of my guests was Susan Scott from the Inner Peace Movement, who had words of consolation for all of us.
Anybody can feel tense at any time, and I think a lot of people do feel it. And, you know, a lot of people worry. You know, we worry about what's going to happen tomorrow, worry what's going to happen next week, next year. In fact, you know, some people even worry because if things are going good, because things are going so good, there has to be something wrong somewhere. We worry that there isn't something to worry about, you know. And this all comes from, you know, different things that we feel within, that we can change all those attitudes if we want. And that's what we work with in the Inner Peace Movement. But basically what we do in the Inner Peace Movement is help a person to understand his real nature, you know, who we really are, what our life is about, what our whole life purpose is about. See, a lot of people suffer tension and worry and anxiety because they lack direction or purpose in their lives. You know, a lot of us feel like, you know, there's something missing in my life. You know, what is it? You know, there's a piece missing somewhere. And we know there's something more, but we don't know what it is. And so we tend to worry a little bit about it. Or maybe we've got a job that's not as fulfilling as we would like it to be. Or even in our personal relationships, we'd like them to be maybe more fulfilling in some ways. And so there's many aspects of our lives that sometimes we feel like we'd just like to get a little bit more out of it, you know?
Well, somebody who's certainly been getting more out of this year in terms of success is Rotherham comedian Paul Shane, who became a star through his appearance in the hit television comedy series Heidi High. In April, he told me how he came to get the part.
Well, the move into acting came as an accident once again. I mean, I went with an agency in Leeds called ATS, City Varieties, and they happened to have a lovely lady there who has television contacts, Miss Barbara Peasland. And she just put me forward to see a few directors, and I got a part. The first part I got was in 71, and it was called A Day Out. It was written by Alan Bennett, marvellous author, and directed by Stephen Frears. And I was in it for the entirety. For 1 month, we had a marvellous time in Halifax and Ripon, and every fourth page, I just had to say, my bum's numb. We were riding bikes, you see, up these cobble streets in Halifax, and anybody's bum would be numb if you're riding about all day on one of them.
Pretty auspicious start, yes, eh? Yes. In the dramatic field, yes. So that's how you got into it?
Yes.
How'd you get into Maplin's prison holiday camp?
Yes. Jimmy Perry and David Croft saw me in 1976, but didn't realise it, doing a thing called Summer Season, which was about a man and wife act on stage, and he was good and she wasn't, and they had a good-looking road manager that she was having an affair with, and he knew, and he didn't want to say anything because he loved her, and he got a lovely kid, and it was very sad, really, funny yet sad, you know? But 4 years went by, and they saw me on Coronation Street in a little bit part again. And it flashed their minds back, because these people have got, they've got memories like elephants. I mean, you know, directors and producers and writers. And they've been looking for me, apparently, for about a year, 18 months. And they'd auditioned all the top London comedy actors, and marvellous actors they are, but they'd never been entertainers in the sense that I do it, you see, cabaret artists. And it called for, like, a 50% that and 50% actor. And, of course, that's how I got the job.
Well, somebody with an unusual job was a forum guest in April, Bill Lawson, a local private detective, who was at pains to point out that his job isn't quite the champagne and Lamborghini lifestyle that people expect.
Yes, I think people do tend to glamorise it, especially on television. It's not at all like that, really. There are no international trips involved on it. People find it's very much simpler to employ inquiry agents and private detectives in other countries without sending me over there, unfortunately.
So it's more Frank Marker than Philip Marlowe?
Indeed, that would be true, yes.
Mm. So what constitutes the vast majority of your work? And surely it's not all actually serving boring subpoenas to old ladies who filled in the wrong HP form.
No, we find that the majority of work that we do is commercial. Obviously, businesses need our services considerably these days. With the divorce laws becoming more easy to get divorced and separated, you find that the matrimonial side of our business has got less. But fortunately, the commercial side has built up over the period of time.
Is it as spicy?
It's not as spicy as it used to be. People fondly imagine that we burst into bedrooms with flash guns popping and what have you. That used to occur in the old days, but it doesn't any longer. You know,
he says with a trace of regret in his voice. Yes. So, I mean, people will all... Let's start at the beginning. People will want to know how Bill Lawson became a private detective.
I think it helps to say that the majority of private detectives are ex-policemen. Obviously, the two occupations follow on. We find that a lot of retired policemen go into this field because they know no other field to go into. I'm a policeman, although not retired, I might add, I'm not old enough. And my partner is a policeman. We have a detective agency which covers South Yorkshire. We find that the amount of business we get in general terms comes from solicitors. The idea of somebody sat in a little office waiting for the glamorous blonde to walk through the door and drop a bundle of pound notes on the desk really doesn't happen all that often.
Keep this date, Monday the 28th, the first day of Atkinson's sale with doorbuster specials like Fogarty polyester quilts, only £9.99. On the line at 9, pillowcases and hand towels, 50 pence, and bath towels, just £1. Then the great home and family bargains throughout the sale include big savings on blankets, now less than half price. So the single-size all-wool Super Merino is only £9.95. In Atkinson's sale, starting on the moor on the 28th at 9 a.m. See the Star Christmas supplement for full details.
You've got it, Radio Howard. Yours in stereo.
Arthur Howard came into the studio recently with a remarkable story of how he, an ordinary Penistone area shepherd, came to record an LP.
Well, there's a man called Ian Russell, and he's been coming to our place, I don't know how long, and I don't know how I came to meet him. He's a doctor of philosophy, which I didn't know until a week or two ago, and he runs a musical book, I believe, as well, once a fortnight. He publishes that one, and he's been coming to our place, as I said, for a fair long time. Well, he's been interested in old characters and the sayings and old dialect and anything of that kind. And I said, we were talking one night, I'd been telling him about these old characters and the sayings, and I said, you know, I said, I ought to write a book.
Well, instead of writing a book, as you said, he recorded an album, 500 of them, and I gather congratulations to Mr. Howard are in order because he's just about sold all of them. Well, finally, on this Christmas Forum special, a word from the Bishop of Sheffield, the Right Reverend David Lunn, when he was on the programme 2 weeks ago. I asked him what his attitude was to those people who only ever go to church for Christmas and other special occasions, like weddings and funerals.
Well, I've got a simple answer. The right way is for the Lord's people to be in the Lord's house on the Lord's day, Sunday by Sunday. But God is in everything. And I think anything that makes people more conscious of the spiritual, more aware that life is more than bread and butter, is a good thing. So I'm, no doubt at all, I'm glad to see them on Christmas midnight or whenever.
Do you use that as a kind of opportunity to make it nice and cosy so that they might be tempted to come another time?
Before I came to Sheffield, I was vicar of a parish, Newcastle. And there we had an immense congregation always at Christmas midnight, almost entirely of teenagers, almost entirely of folks who didn't come at other times in the year. I always had a strict rule. Keep the service moving, keep it deep. A lot of sense of the other world, the grandeur, the glory, the mystery of Christmas. Lots of incense. It was a very profound service, moving fast, and a sermon in which I never, never, never nagged them, but always tried to say something that spoke to their lives as they were being lived, something of God in their lives now.
And maybe that's something we could all do with making a little room for whichever form of worship you follow during 1982. From me, Roger Brooks, with our thanks to engineer Rob Hodgson, hope you've enjoyed the programme. We'll be back with some live guests again next week at 6 o'clock.